Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
You may be seated. Good morning. Our first case is 7-1741, State of Ohio versus Edward Lee Lang. Ms. Troutman.
Thank you, Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I'd like to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal.
How many?
10 minutes, please. Today I'm going to focus my argument on proposition of law number one. A relative of the victim had pervasive contact with Eddie Lang's jury. She, in fact, sat on the jury for a portion of the trial. We are, at the least, requesting that this court remand the case to the trial court for a hearing in accordance with Remmer versus United States. After juror 386 was dismissed, the trial judge asked the remaining 11 jurors only one question. He told the jurors that 386 may have had a relative relationship with either a witness or a party or someone who was involved in the case, and then he asked, is there any member of the jury at all that she did discuss this with at all, referring to her relationship to the jurors? No one answered, and there was no further inquiry. The trial immediately continued. Appellant's brief gets this wrong. In front of this court, it is stated that the trial judge asked the jurors if they had discussed the case with juror 386, which is not, in fact, what happened. It was simply that one question. And the law requires a deeper inquiry. According to Remmer and Smith versus Phillips and this court, the trial judge is required to determine the circumstances, determine the impact thereof upon the juror, and determine whether or not the circumstances were prejudicial in a hearing with all interested parties permitted to participate. It's true that trial courts are granted broad discretion in how to deal with a biased juror, whether to declare a mistrial or to replace the affected juror. But the problem here is that the court never had the information necessary to determine the impact upon the rest of the jurors.
Ms. Troutman, did either counsel request that the court inquire further? Was there any objection to the way the court handled this particular issue?
The trial judge was notified of the potential problem. There was not, at the time when the trial court asked the one question of the remaining jurors, defense counsel did not speak up. And in fact, that has been raised as an error under Proposition of Law 10, sub 3. The trial judge, however, was alerted to the problem by defense counsel. Once the court was alerted of the fact that juror 386 was related to the victim's family, defense counsel requested that the court question the juror at that point so that they could determine whether, in fact, she was related and what impact she had had on the rest of the jurors.
And that questioning was in the presence of both attorneys, correct?
Correct.
And there was no objection to the court after that questioning occurred?
After the questioning occurred, no, Your Honor, there was
not. And that juror then was dismissed?
Yes.
All right.
Had that juror continued to deliberations, then, in fact, Eddie Lang would be entitled to a new trial under this court's case law in Grundy versus Dillon and the U.S. Supreme Court in McDonough. However, she was dismissed, but again, there was no determination as to what impact she had on the rest of the jury. And this is not this is in fact a mandatory requirement under this court's case law. This court stated in State versus Stallings, when a trial court learns of an improper outside communication with a juror, it must hold a hearing to determine whether the communication biased the juror.
You don't think that the questioning to the actual juror was enough of a hearing and the question to the jury panel as a whole was enough to make that determination?
No, Your Honor, it was not.
Have we in the past created a procedure that the court must follow? Have we stated that there are certain questions that must be asked and the manner in which those questions must be asked?
This court has never outlined the specific procedure as to what must occur. It has, however, determined that the court must determine whether or not there's been a prejudicial impact upon the rest of the jurors.
Well, counsel, wasn't there the question asked of the juror 386, have you talked to anybody in the jury about this? She answered in the negative. The court then inquired for corroboration of the jurors if there had been, in fact, any communication, and they corroborated her statement. No, there was no discussion. So What is the basis, what evidence do you have besides your speculation?
Well, for one thing, Juror 386 was not truthful with the trial court, and we know that because on her jury questionnaire, she was asked specifically what personal knowledge she had about the case, and she only responded that she knew from a newspaper article that the victims had been shot.
Do you think that because she wasn't truthful in that portion of her inquiry, she wasn't truthful to the judge the second time she was, or when she was asked the question about her communication with her fellow jurors?
Well, yes, that's part of the problem.
But that was corroborated by the fellow jurors saying, no, in fact, she hasn't discussed it with us.
And that's the only thing she had not discussed, if we believe the juror and we believe the rest of the jurors, was the fact that she was related to the victim's family. When in fact, if there had been some sort of communication between this juror and the rest of the jurors, and the fact that the rest of the jurors didn't know that she was related to the victim's family, then they had no reason to take what she was saying with that sort of grain of salt. They didn't know her bias was, in fact.
So you think that the juror members were discussing the case, not just the relationship between Juror 386 and the decedent, but that the jurors were, all of them, or some of them at least, were engaged in improper discussions about the case prior to deliberations?
No, I think that is the risk, Your Honor. And then in this court's case law, in other cases, in other such situations where, for example, in State versus Stallings, there was a man who approached a few of the jurors and made a comment, and so the trial court was required to conduct an inquiry with those jurors. And after the inquiry, and because it was a minor incident, because it was the outside influence's personal opinion that he had expressed to the jurors, and because of the way the trial court had handled it, this court found that there was no abuse of discretion. Similarly, in State versus Sanders, there was a situation in which there were demonstrators outside the courthouse, and they approached a few of the jurors and said something along the lines of, there he goes. The trial court, this court found there was no error because of the manner in which the trial court conducted its inquiry. The trial court questioned specifically the jurors that had been approached, and then it questioned the rest of the panel, asked specifically if anybody had been impacted by this. It then addressed the fact that these outsiders were not in any way relevant to the proceedings, and it informed the jurors that they were harmless. None of that occurred here. The only thing we know is that the trial jurors were requested to ask one question. Did Juror 386 inform you about her relation at all? And in fact, we know from earlier—
Why would there be a basis to go beyond that? Because that was the information that she withheld on the voir dire. So if that was that is what is the crux of the problem with the presence of 386 is her connection to the victim. And there is no evidence to support that she, because she was a relative of the victim, talk to the rest of the jury about any of the testimony or the proceedings that had gone on up to that point. Your only focus and the only flaw that I can see here is that she was not honest with her relationship. There's nothing further to suggest that she then talked about the caliber or the credibility of the evidence that they were hearing up to that point.
Correct. What we know, Your Honor, is that Juror 386 lied to get on the jury. We don't know why. We know that she, during voir dire, even when she was placed under oath, and for 10 pages after the court requested the jurors to disclose any person they knew, and jurors went on to discuss about police officers that were a cousin or a judge that they happened to know, and she sat silent. And then when Juror 385, who was right next to her, spoke up to the trial court and informed the court that she knew the victim, Marnell Cheek, and the court removed Juror 385. Juror 386 still sat there silently. So we know that Juror 386 was not honest and got on the jury. We don't know why. What we do know also is that she spent 3 days closely with the rest of the jurors on the panel. We know from the record that she was friendly with Juror 387, who was next to her. That, under this court's case law and under the United States Supreme Court case law, requires a further determination as to whether or not there was some sort of prejudicial impact upon the rest of the jurors. For example, in State versus Frazier, There is, one of the jurors was approached by a man who later was determined to have been the brother of the victim's boyfriend. Literally, all that ended up occurring was he approached her and asked if she was a juror, I believe. That alone, however, required a hearing. The juror had to be questioned about what happened, about what occurred. The victim's boyfriend's brother was questioned about what occurred, and this court found that because of the what occurred during the two, because of the conversation, that there was no prejudice, and therefore there was no need for a new trial. However, again, there was that further inquiry. We know here that the juror 386 was not a valid juror in this case, that if she would have continued on to deliberations, that Eddie Lang would be entitled to a new trial.
But that's all we know. We all know that she was inappropriately, let's put it this way, she did not disclose her relationship. The cases that you're mentioning, there was an actual interaction that precipitated additional inquiry by the court. There were people to be identified to be asked further questions. So it wasn't speculative that there was a connection or that there was a conversation. Here, you're just basing it on speculation. There is no concrete example that you could proffer. For example, juror 387 and juror 386 were seen hovered in a corner, you know, whispering in a low voice to one another, or any sort of information or evidence that comes to us that way.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I think the speculation here would be the same speculation as took place in Frazier. All that was known there was that a member of the victim's family approached one of the jurors. There was no knowledge about what exactly occurred and whether or not there was any prejudice. In fact, what the juror even reported to the court was just something, it was just a minor communication, and it still went further from there. Furthermore, the problem here is also, we can't forget juror 386, her deceitfulness to the court, and the fact that while she was under oath, she lied to the court about her knowledge of the case. She was actually at the funeral, viewed the body, had attended, had been at the mother's house, knew members of the family. So the fact that she withheld all of this information from the court, I think even though we don't know her motives for getting on the jury, we can assume that they were not pure or to the defendant's advantage. And we also know from the court that she had a friendly relationship with juror 387. The trial court, especially since after juror 385 was removed from the court, was removed as a juror, and nobody spoke up when the judge asked, did she discuss this with you, and does anybody know anything further about the case? And nobody spoke up. Everybody was silent. And then he found out later on that, in fact, somebody did know. Juror 386 had not been honest. At that point, the judge should have at least handled things a little bit differently the next time around and perhaps engaged in it what he's required to do under law and engaged in the further inquiry under Remmer. Excuse me. This court has made very specific inquiries into or examined the cases on the exact facts when it looks at whether or not an outside influence has potentially prejudiced the rest of the jurors. And it has not, the trial court has not, in having a Remmer hearing, required first that he be convinced that some prejudice had occurred. That is the point of the Remmer hearing, to determine whether or not there was, in fact, some prejudice. And as Justice O'Connor pointed out in her concurrence in Smith versus Phillips, there are certain circumstances where we should still presume where there still is an implied bias. Again, we don't know why juror 386 lied, and it isn't too much of a stretch to assume that it wasn't for the purest of motives. And determining whether a juror is biased or has prejudged a case is difficult, according to the U.S. Supreme Court, partly because the juror may have an interest in concealing his own bias, and partly because the juror may be aware of it. This case faced another example in State versus Hennis, where we presume, again, that jurors follow the instructions that are given to them and that they would not discuss the case amongst themselves. However, evidence was brought to the court that there had been an outside influence upon the jury, that they had been approached by a witness. The jurors hadn't brought it to the court's attention. And at that point, the court was required to conduct the inquiry. The defense counsel did not agree that the inquiry was sufficient. However, this court found that it was sufficient because, again, of the very fact-specific nature of—
Do you have any other cases applying Remmer where prejudice was found by a reviewing court?
Excuse me, Your Honor.
You keep telling us that Remmer requires an inquiry by the court. And in response to the chief's questions, you've indicated that the court did conduct an inquiry. It satisfied itself that the juror, for whatever reason, didn't tell the truth, but also didn't communicate that information to any other member of the panel. And then the court asked all the rest of the members whether or not any information had been divulged to them. And the court satisfied itself that therefore there was no prejudice because there were no such communication. My question to you is, do you have any case authority on any other cases applying Remmer in similar instances that we could look to determine what else the court could have done?
Well, specifically, there was no Remmer inquiry here. The only thing the court satisfied itself of was the fact that juror 386 had not told the rest of the jurors that she was related to the victim.
Well, the court's required to determine what the circumstances are under Remmer, right?
Yes.
And it did that, correct? It determined that there was no communication from this juror to the panel, and the panel confirmed that there were no such communications.
The only thing the panel confirmed, Your Honor, was that she had not told them that she was related to the victim.
And if she hadn't told them that relationship, then what else would you have the court go to?
Those are the circumstances, that the victim's family member was on the jury. So that, yes, the court determined those circumstances. It also determined that apparently the rest of the panel did not know that she was, in fact, one of the victim's family members. But what it did not do is determine whether or not there had been any further communication, whether or not juror 386, whatever her motives, whether or not she had furthered those motives, and in any discussions with the juror, it recognized that she had a friendly relationship with the juror sitting next to her, juror 387, but it never inquired as to whether or not there was communication about the case, her opinions.
Which brings me back to the question that I want you to try to answer. Are there any other reported case authorities from an appellate reviewing court applying Remmer that we could look to in support of your position?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, first of all, there is nothing of this extreme nature. None of the outside communications with the juror has ever been where it is literally a victim's family member sitting with the rest of the jurors. However, there are other cases where an appellate court has employed the Remmer test. For example, in United States versus Davis, which this court referred to in its Sanders opinion. One of the jurors had members of the community apparently had found out that he was a juror, and the juror admitted that he was concerned that he was going to face retaliation because of the fact that he had been on this jury. And he admitted later on that he had discussed his fear with the rest of the jurors.
Well, that's factually different from this case.
Correct, Your Honor. There was a further inquiry in which the juror then admitted that he had in fact discussed his fears with the rest of the jurors. But the trial judge made no attempt to determine what effect that contact had on the rest of the jurors, and he didn't instruct the jurors to disregard whatever the dismissed juror had told them, and so the Sixth Circuit remanded it back down to the district court for a Remmer inquiry. And that is precisely what is necessary here. Maybe we don't know the extent of the prejudice, but that's what a Remmer hearing is for, and that's what the trial court failed to do, is determine what communication occurred between juror 386 and the rest of the jurors, if any, and whether or not there was a prejudicial effect upon the rest of his jury.
Ms. Troutman, I know that you want to spend the bulk of your argument on proportion on the jury, so I have not asked this question previously, but I have some concern about proportionality. It seems in this case that Mr. Walker, I believe the co-defendant's name is, was the older person who initiated this offense and apparently made the race to the prosecutor before Mr. Lang did. But the judge seemed to give very short shrift to any mitigation with regard to the defendant's age, just 18, I believe, at the time of the offense. How would you have us measure that in terms of mitigation? And do you have any information on Walker's age? I couldn't find that.
Walker was the older party. I don't exactly remember his age. I think he was in his 20s. Eddie was 3 days past his 19th birthday at the time of the crime. And there's also been a weight of the evidence and sufficiency of the evidence claim raised in this case. And as this court knows, when the weight of the evidence is raised, it is this court's duty to determine whether or not it supports the actual conviction. And we would maintain that the burden has not been established as far as Eddie Lang being the principal offender. And if you review the record as a whole, you'll see that there are certain circumstances especially that go to perhaps there's a more likely than not standard that's been met. But for example, there is no blood that was found on Mr. Lang's clothing, despite the fact that the victims were shot very close range with hollow point bullets to produce the maximum amount of damage.
And Mr. Walker's clothing was never tested.
Mr. Walker's clothing was his hooded sweatshirt was brought in with him 2 days after the offense, and he himself turned it over. Eddie Lang's clothing had been obtained by the police upon his arrest. And Eddie Lang's clothing also had mud and material on it and his own blood from when he had jumped out of the car. So we know he hadn't washed his clothing in between the time of the shooting and the time that his clothing had been obtained. And furthermore, there is the minor DNA profile that was on the gun. Antoine Walker was not excluded as the source of that DNA. The state has made a lot of hay about the fact that Eddie Lang can't be excluded as the source of the major DNA, but neither of them have been excluded from the source of the minor DNA.
And the jury split the difference. So they gave life without parole on the drug dealer's sentence and then gave the death penalty on Ms. Cheek's conviction.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think that goes to show that this jury was definitely willing to consider the mitigating evidence in this case. And especially, I mean, Eddie, again, he was just 3 days past his 19th birthday. He, the prosecutor minimized his mitigation and made it sound as if he had a good life up until the age of 10, and then it wasn't so good from 10 to 12, and then he was happy, got a little depressed. In fact, he was on medication like Risperdal and Depakote. These are heavy medications that a child is required to take. His father was a heroin and a cocaine addict. He was kidnapped from his mother, essentially, for 2 years. And when he was returned to his mother, he was in the same clothing that he had been in when he was dropped off to his father in June, and it was December when he was picked up. His shoes were too small. He was undernourished. He had cigarette burns on his body, and his mother described him as fragile. As his physical injuries healed, his emotional injuries became evident, and he never recovered from that. And yes, Your Honor, I think that the jury was willing to consider that mitigating evidence, and had it had the opportunity to also adequately consider the, had defense counsel adequately presented the case about the DNA, about the gunshot or the blood not being on Eddie's clothing, and challenging the state's position that the casing on the passenger seat, behind the case, the passenger seat, they used that as evidence of Eddie's guilt, saying that when the gun was shot, the casing was kicked back to the right, and therefore it landed on the passenger seat, and therefore that proved that Eddie Lang was the shooter somehow. What it failed to mention, however, was that after the shooting, the car with the victims in it traveled through 5 yards, through three fences, over a rock, hit a tree, ended up hitting a lion statue. The car was then towed back to a warehouse before the evidence was even found. So there's no way to have any confidence whatsoever in where the casing had been located. So yes, Your Honor, there are several reasons why this court should be troubled by both the conviction and the sentence in this case, and at the very least should remand back to the trial court in order to have a full record as to what occurred with Juror 386 and the rest of the jurors. I'm going to reserve my remaining time for rebuttal if this court has no further questions.
Thank you. Ms. Yatarsky.
Good morning, Madam Chief Justice. May it please the court. On behalf of the state of Ohio, we request that you reject the arguments of Lange, find that the aggravating circumstances outweigh the mitigating factors, and impose the sentence of death for the killing of Ms. Marnell Cheek. Lange, while he was age 19, when he did the killings, he was born and raised in Baltimore, Maryland. He lived in Canton, Ohio for approximately 4 months, and in that time, he killed two members of the Stark County community. He did this by executing them, putting a 9mm pistol loaded with hollow point bullets to their heads. He committed this senseless act because he wanted to rob Jaron Burnett of his money and drugs. The Stark County grand jury properly indicted him on two counts of aggravated murder with firearm specifications and two death penalty specifications. Those were the course of conduct, multiple killings, that was the A5 specification, and the felony murder based upon the aggravated robbery. I'd like to address the juror number 386 problem that Mr. Lange's counsel has indicated. First of all, this juror's potential prejudice came to light when Mr. Cheek's father told the prosecutor that this juror number 386's mother was married to Cheek's brother. It did not come to the attention of the court through the defense counsel. When that occurred, the jury was down in the jury room, and the court discussed this matter with both defense and the prosecutor, with Mr. Lange there. Because this was, I believe, one of the only, I think she was the only African-American juror that was available. Of course, the court was concerned about potential Batson issues, and so carefully discussed this with both the prosecutor and the state. This juror number 386 was then voir dired, and it came to light that indeed she did have a relationship. She did attend the funeral, etc. At that time, both the defense and prosecution decided that this juror should be removed for cause.
Counsel, you said they first discussed the Batson issues.
That wasn't discussed, Justice Pfeiffer, but I believe that the issue was, because this was the only African-American juror, that there was that really brought up some discussion about whether this juror should be removed or whether she
really
could. Yes.
I mean, could there be any doubt that this juror has to be removed?
Well, this was before they had the voir dire the juror. There was a discussion between the defense and the prosecution. Then that juror was brought up for discussion. And Justice Pfeiffer, there was no doubt after that juror was voir dired that both the prosecution and the defense counsel agreed that that juror should be removed. And in terms of the Remmer hearing, as this court knows in Remmer, that was a case where a outside third party told the juror he could benefit from sitting on the jury. When the FBI investigated that, they found out that this was said in jest, and that juror was allowed to deliberate. In this case, there's absolutely no showing of prejudice. This juror was removed. The trial court appropriately asked the other jurors whether this juror had discussed any relationship, and they were told, and the trial court was told, that there was absolutely no discussion.
After determining that the juror needed to be removed, why did the judge allow her to then sit through two more witnesses?
Your Honor, I would agree with you that the better practice would have been at that point to excuse the jury and have that voir dire of that juror at that particular time and not allowed the two witnesses to testify. However, there is absolutely no showing of prejudice as a result of that. The testimony and the record shows that the jurors were on break at the time. They were instructed not to discuss this matter, and immediately after the break, they were brought up and heard the testimony of the two witnesses. There was no time for them to discuss any issues with juror number 386. Now, in my research, there are two cases from Ohio that this court has discussed this issue, and that is the Sanders issue that the Sanders case that Mr. Lang's counsel brought up, and that was the case involving the Lucasville riot, when one of the jurors indicated that he could not be fair because of the Muslim garb of the defendant, and he said this in front of the other potential jurors. At that point, there was a discussion, and this court found that that juror was not excused, and this court found that there was no prejudice. There is another case, a Phillips case, that this court discussed that matter, and that was the beating and death of a child. And in that case, a grand juror came up to the jurors and made an out-of-court statement to them about the deliberations at the grand jury. Again, this court did not remove that. The trial court did not remove that juror, and this court did not find that that was prejudicial. Here, there is absolutely no prejudice because juror number 386 was there for that short period of time, and Lang can point to no prejudice. Indeed, there was no objection from Mr. Lang's trial counsel. And in fact, the most important thing is juror number 386 never deliberated about this matter. The trial court properly handled this by asking the other jurors and excusing juror number 386 for cause.
Exactly what did the judge ask the other jurors?
Your Honor, I can't remember the exact words, but I think he conveyed to the jurors that juror number 386 had been excused because of some relationship with one of the witnesses or one of the parties, and asked the jurors if they had any communication with juror number 386 over that issue, and they indicated that they did not.
But wouldn't the danger not be, had this juror disclosed that she had a connection with a victim, and I take it the jury wasn't told that, it was more vague, but wouldn't the danger be if this person who had a connection with the victim expressed some view of the case before she was excused?
There's no evidence that that occurred.
Was that question asked, though?
I do not believe in those particular words that
trial court asked. Isn't that the more important question?
Whether the juror expressed a view about this?
Of the case, yes.
That would have been an important question. However, I believe that the trial court's question did encompass that. Did this juror 386 disclose anything to you? And also, Justice Pfeiffer, the jury was told that they were only to consider the evidence that they heard at the trial. They were not to disclose, they were not to consider any other evidence. And there's no indication that they did not, and that they did not follow the instructions of the trial court on this. With regard to the proportionality issue or the mitigation issue that you raised, Justice McGee Brown, Mr. Walker was age 22, so he was approximately 2 to 3 years older than Mr. Lang. But with regard to Mr. Lang's age, I would like to speak to that. Lang may have been 18, 19 at the time he committed this execution-style killing, but he was by no way a naive 18 or 19-year-old, as found by the trial court in its opinion. He was a street-smart kid. He In his statement to the police, when this court reviews it, they will see that this Mr. Lang knew all of the ramifications. He said, at most, I am guilty of complicity to commit murder. He was not a naive 18-year-old when he committed these senseless killings. He was a street smart, wise kid that shot and killed two people execution style.
But so was Mr. Walker. That's when I look at the proportionality, the court, you know, the prosecutor made a deal with Mr. Walker, obviously, and determined that he was not the shooter, but the court was very dismissive of Mr. Lang's childhood, that he had 30 visits to psychiatric institutions, that he was on psychotropic medications, that he'd been physically and sexually abused by his father and neglected, and at 12 years old weighed 90 pounds. And the judge gave that very minimal in terms of mitigation. And that was my question to Ms. Troutman, is where on the continuum would you weigh that in a proportionality and mitigation sense?
Justice McGee-Brown, I do not believe that the trial court gave a short shrift to that. What it did was it weighed the aggravating circumstances of two cold-blooded killings in the course of an aggravated robbery against the dysfunctional childhood of Mr. Lang. And the state agreed that Mr. Lang did have a dysfunctional childhood. But this court has never found that a dysfunctional childhood can outweigh the aggravating circumstances of a course of conduct, a killing of two people in the course of an aggravated robbery. There was a case that I believe this court heard in which it did find that the mitigating factors outweighed the aggravating circumstances. In that case, I believe it was Venable. This court found that it was tenace, T-E-N-A-C-E, and in this court found that the aggravating circumstances did not outweigh the mitigating. But in that case, it was very different than Mr. Lang's case. While the defendant there had a dysfunctional childhood, it was very dysfunctional in that his parents took him out to commit crimes. The defendant there expressed remorse for his actions. He cooperated with the police. We have nothing like that here with Mr. Lang. In fact, as this court knows when it reads the record, at the sentencing hearing, Mr. Lang, in answer to Mr. Burdett's sister's statement about the killing of her brother, when Ms. said, that's what he did, bitch, he pled for his life. He begged for his life. That is not the remorse that was shown in other cases where this court has considered the mitigating circumstances. The dysfunctional childhood of Mr. Lang was egregious. The state admits that, but weighing that against the aggravating circumstances here, they did not outweigh it. With regard
to... Counsel, there was mention made that Mr. Lang had been treated with various medications for his depression and other mental conditions. My understanding is he was not on prescription medications for that at the time he engaged in this activity. Is that correct?
Chief Justice, I don't remember in the record that was an indication. I don't believe there was any testimony that he was on medication.
There was no indication that he lacked capacity in any way as a result of a mental infirmity?
No, there was no evidence in mitigation of any mental infirmity in Mr. Lang. Very early on, certified trial counsel received the assistance of a mitigation specialist, a psychologist, and we know that from the record. While ineffective assistance is more appropriately discussed in a post-conviction relief, there is evidence in the record that he had the benefit of all of those services. And in fact, this court, when it reviews the record, will see from the billings that were submitted to the courts that there were psychological testing given to Mr. Lang, and there was a reason, apparently, that the trial counsel of Mr. Lang did not bring these up. Perhaps it showed some gang activity, which this court will also see in the record from the discovery here. Perhaps there was nothing more than a sociopathic, psychopathic personality here. So while Mr. Lang had the benefit of all those services, the trial counsel here decided to humanize Mr. Lang by just having his mother and his half-sister testify.
Counsel, there's an allegation that because of the scarcity of the DNA on the weapon,
yes,
that it should have been suppressed, and that was not a request made by defense counsel?
Yeah, there were over 70 motions filed by defense counsel here, and while I can't recall exactly, I'm sure that there was a motion to suppress somewhere in there. However, the DNA really went to the fact that there was no DNA of Mr. Walker found on the gun, and that went to the defense of Mr. Lang. There was no doubt that Mr. Lang, that was his gun. It was found in the car. Mr. Lang admitted to the police that, hey, this is my gun. So the fact that there was his DNA on it was not a surprise to anyone. The more important thing that was brought up by the DNA was the lack of Mr. Walker's DNA on the gun. Your Honor, for these reasons and those cited in the brief, the state asks that this court independently weigh the aggravating circumstances, that is, the execution-style killing of two persons during an aggravated robbery, and find that the aggravating circumstances outweigh the mitigating factors. The state requests that this court find that the death sentence is appropriate in this case and impose the sentence of death on Mr. Lang. If there are no further questions, I will rest. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Outman, you've reserved little under 6 minutes for your rebuttal. I want to direct you to your statement about the DNA. I got the impression from your first argument here was that the DNA on the weapon was not, that it could have been either Walker or Lang's DNA, and yet the testimony was questioned, do you have an opinion as to a reasonable degree of scientific certainty whose DNA appeared on the handgun? In this particular case, we can say that Antonio Walker is not the source of the DNA that we detected from the swabbing of the handgun, but they could not exclude your client.
Correct. That is true for the major source of DNA. There was both a major source and a minor source on the gun. The major source, Eddie Langstein, could not be excluded as the source, but Antonio Walker could be. Mm-hmm. The minor source, neither of them could be excluded. The amount of DNA was too small for to exclude anybody. And furthermore, that's the state's argument right there is exactly why the admission of the testimony about the DNA evidence was prejudicial. The admission of the testimony of Michelle Foster about the DNA, about the fact that she was able to testify not to a reasonable degree of scientific certainty, but because her testimony was admitted, the state was then permitted in its closing argument to make an argument that Walker was excluded as the source of the DNA, and that's not true. If this court reviews Ms. Foster's testimony, you will see that Mr. Walker was not excluded as the source of the minor source of DNA.
It is true that the initial questions about the identified DNA, it was true that Ms. Foster could exclude Mr. Walker as being the source of that DNA.
Of one of the sources. There was more than one type of DNA.
I understand that. But
yes,
if you're taking the examination incrementally, they made that distinction as well at
trial. Absolutely. Yes, Your Honor.
That we have this source of DNA. We can definitely exclude Mr. Walker. We cannot exclude Mr. Lang.
Correct.
And that's a true statement.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Not to a reasonable degree of scientific certainty, but yes, that is the testimony.
Your defendant has an extensive history of psychiatric problems and treatment. What exactly was the testimony about his mental condition at the time of the crime? Was he under treatment with any psychiatrist? I don't believe there's any testimony he had on medications. What around the period surrounding the crime itself, what was the testimony about any psychiatric issues at that time?
There was no psychiatric testimony presented about Mr. Lang's mental state at the time of the crime. His mother is the only one who testified about the fact that he had been in over 28 psychiatric hospitals, including emergency treatment centers, and she discussed the fact that he had been, as a child, treated with drugs such as Risperdal and Depakote. And
but did you have his, did you your was your client examined by a psychiatrist?
Yes, Your Honor, he was. And in fact, the
did they call the psychiatrist?
No, they did not.
Do we have to assume there's reasons that they did not?
You could assume that, or you could look at the post-conviction motion in support of jurisdiction that is in front of this court, and that will show you exactly what the problem was. And in fact, Eddie Lang has been diagnosed as bipolar since the age of 8 years old, and all of those records were available to the court. That is not in front of they were not disclosed, they were not turned over, no expert testimony was presented. So no, Eddie Lang did not have a diagnosis of antisocial personality.
That's really an issue we should be considering under post-conviction.
Yes, Your Honor.
Brings in evidence outside this record.
Absolutely, Your Honor, yes. However, the state has made the statement that we can assume that he had some sort of antisocial diagnosis, which in fact is not accurate. Lang made a horrible statement to the Burdett sister, but don't forget this was a 19-year-old unmedicated child who, again, has been diagnosed as bipolar, although it is not before this court, and he'd just been told that he was going to die by 12 people. That doesn't make it better. However, if this court takes that into consideration in determining whether or not Mr. Lang should be executed, I would also request that it should take into consideration the fact that Marnell Cheek's family requested the court to not execute Eddie Lang. The state assured this court, or claimed that the trial court was assured that there was no discussion about the case between the jurors, but that's not true. If you look at the trial transcript 952 to 953, you'll see the exact question that was asked, and the only question that was asked was whether juror 386 told the jurors that she was related to the victims. The question about whether or not any discussion or impact regarding the case is encompassed in that, I don't believe it could be. At the very least, this court should remand the case back down to the trial court to have a hearing under Remmer versus United States. And Eddie Lang is not deserving of the ultimate sentence in this case. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision.